Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along to the Sydney Institute tonight, folks. It's our first night at the Gallipoli Club, but so far it's going well, and we're grateful you've all come. And we're grateful that Scott Morrison is making a welcome return to the Sydney Institute at a very busy time in his political itinerary. I'll introduce our speaker very briefly. He has a science honours degree from the University of New South Wales. He's worked with the Property Council, with the Australian Tourism Task Force, with the Tourism Council. He was State Director of the Liberal Party in New South Wales, and of course since 2007, the Member for Cook. And he's had a number of important parliamentary positions, but currently the very significant position of the Shadow Minister for Productivity and Population and the Shadow Minister for Immigration and Citizenship. And tonight Mr. Morrison's going to address the Sydney Institute on the topic Australia's Immigration Future Under a Coalition Government. Mr. Morrison, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Jared. It's a great thrill to be here back at the Sydney Institute in my hometown. I've been in many towns over the last 30 days or so, and it's great to be here back in Sydney. It's great to be also back a little later tonight in my beloved Shire, and I know there's a few Shire residents here tonight. I've seen a few already in the crowd, so look forward to heading back along General Holmes Drive a little later tonight. But it's tremendous to be here in this wonderful room and this wonderful club, and to be here to support also the Sydney Institute, which does such a, I think, an outstanding job under Jared's leadership over so many years in providing thought leadership in any number of spaces within the public debate. And it is always a great honour to be able to address the Sydney Institute, and I thank you for coming out tonight to hear our thoughts on what is a subject very dear to my heart, and one that has increasingly become so over the last 4 years where I've served as the Shadow Minister for Immigration. There are other portfolios, but that is the one that I suspect people are most familiar with. It's a job that Tony Abbott gave me some years ago, and it's been a privilege to serve with him as part of his team. And as we go forth to an election in a few days' time, it really has been a team effort on our side of politics, and a very stable team at that. And the ability to have that stability over several years in a portfolio aids greatly the process of policy development, aids greatly the process of preparation if we are indeed to be successful at the election on Saturday. I think, without doubt, our most significant, and I think our longest serving, certainly, but also I think most successful immigration minister was Philip Ruddock. And Philip greatly benefited from that time going into the 1996 election as being a shadow minister of immigration prior to that. And that is certainly an experience that has been had its moments over the last few years, I can certainly attest to. But with an election just a few days away, I can say that if we are given that opportunity, that we are ready. And tonight I wanted to share just some of our thoughts on the topic of immigration and some specific issues in more detail. In 2001, John Howard said, and I was pleased to be there, he said, "We will decide who comes to this country in the circumstances in which they come." He said, "We will do that within the framework of the decency for which Australians have always been renowned." He said, "We will be compassionate. We will save lives. We will care for people, but we will decide, and nobody else, who comes to this country." That statement, I think, more than any other, summarises the Coalition's view, and in particular the Liberal Party's philosophy and statement when it comes to immigration policy in this country. Immigration has made the Australia we know today. It has made us a stronger Australia. Australia has a well-earned reputation as arguably, and I would say the most successful and cohesive multi-ethnic society in the world today. And there are many reasons that we can be confident that this will continue into the future. But we cannot take it for granted. Protecting the integrity of our immigration program is critical to our continued success, whether it is our refugee and humanitarian program, skilled migration, student and investor visas. But an immigration program cannot be successful without the strong support of the Australian people. And the Rudd-Gillard government inherited a robust immigration program from the coalition government that Australians trusted. And I believe Labor has broken that trust over the last 6 years. I can appreciate that many Australians have lost confidence in this government's ability to enforce our immigration laws when they see what has happened all around this country over many years. By sharp contrast, the Howard Coalition government ran an immigration program that Australians could have confidence in and could be proud of. And importantly, it was a program that was based on the long-held belief that migration is a nation-building initiative. Robert Menzies called it the greatest exercise in nation-building for Australia that this century has seen in the last century. He said the Liberal Party has been at the vanguard of these efforts. And we have. It was the Liberal Menzies government who signed the Refugee Convention in 1954 and embraced an ambitious post-war program of immigration. In 1960, it was the Liberal Party who abolished the White Australia policy from its party platform 5 whole years before the ALP made a similar change. In its place, the party affirmed the internationally recognised principle of every country having the right to decide its own immigration policy according to its own circumstances, close quote. This sentiment was echoed by John Howard, as I've just referred to. It was the Holt government that actually removed the White Australia policy from our national laws. It was the Fraser government who adopted the Garbelli Report recommendations, which included the establishment of the SBS, the extension of ethnic radio services, a major orientation program for new arrivals, the introduction of innovative English language instruction, boosts for the Child Migrant Education Program, and the establishment of a network of migrant resource centres. It was Malcolm Fraser's Liberal government that responded to a genuine regional refugee crisis, resettling an average of 8,630 Indo-Chinese refugees a year between the 1st of July 1975 and 30 June 1981. And in 1982, and negotiated an agreement with Vietnam for an orderly departure program to reunite families of Vietnamese refugees already in Australia in an orderly and authorised way. It was the Fraser government that established the offshore processing centre at Galang. In many ways, Malcolm Fraser was indeed the pioneer in the Liberal Party of offshore processing in this country. The Fraser government established the Immigration Review Tribunal, the Australian Refugee Advisory Council, the Communities Refugee Settlement Scheme, and the provision of social support orientation assistance in finding employment and accommodation. The Determination of Refugee Status Committee was introduced, along with the Special Humanitarian Program, which I think plays a very important role today in our thinking about these matters. It was in 1996 that the Howard government inherited from Labor an immigration program that lacked a clear economic rationale. It was dominated by family reunion and was bringing in many migrants depending on welfare support, and it was severely open to fraud. It had lost the support of the Australian people. Our longest-serving Immigration Minister, Philip Ruddock, introduced reforms to sharpen the program's economic focus, reduced the size of the family reunion component, and restricted new migrants' access to welfare. Australia's success as an immigration nation is based fundamentally on our commitment to the economic participation of migrants at all levels. We have always valued the involvement of migrants in our economy. The Coalition's policies are all about restoring the proven measures and response of the Howard government to things that worked when we were last in office. Under that program, the percentage of Australians who were concerned about immigration levels being too high almost halved, from more than two-thirds to just over a third. And over the same period, our permanent immigration intake doubled. Those who had the skills to find employment were the priority of our scheme. Over the 10 years to 2005-06, unemployment for skilled migrants fell from 9% to just 3%, better than the national average, and labour force participation rates were also higher. It was a generous program. We had a proud record of welcoming people from more than 140 countries. In 2003, $100.9 million was committed over 4 years to improve settlement services. And on our borders, the Howard government stopped the boats, while resettling about 150,000 refugee and humanitarian entrants. It was also a compassionate program. Over 10 years, the Howard government provided more than 52,800 offshore special humanitarian visas with an average of more than 5,000 places each year. Last year, in 2011-12, those number of places fell to just over 700. This is what you can achieve when Australians have confidence in their government to run a program with stability and integrity. And this is what you can achieve when Australians have confidence in the government to run a program with stability and integrity. Sadly, Labor have betrayed that confidence. In abandoning the measures that we saw the Howard government put in place, Labor inherited a solution and they've created a problem. Today at the press club, I outline in some detail the cost of those failures, of the chaos and the cost and the tragedy that has occurred. The budget has been blown by more than 11 billion, around 15,000 people who are waiting in desperate places all around the world have been denied visas that they would otherwise have got under our special humanitarian program because of Labor have handed those visas to those who've come the way we don't want them to come. The number of those visas, I said, has fell to 714 per year when they're over 5,000 under the Howard government. We have seen more than 1,100 people perish at sea. These are the consequences of a decision taken by the Labor government to get rid of the measures that worked. You know, in this space, there is no decision you take that is free of moral burden when it comes to immigration, and particularly on our borders. Even if a measure is motivated by compassion, even if a measure is motivated by a hope that a more compassionate outcome may result, if that is not the result, and the result is 1,100 people dead, and the result is 50,000 people turning up by that method, and 15,000 people denied a visa, then that is a heavy, heavy moral burden, I think, for any government to carry. And frankly, if I had to choose between the burden carried by the Howard government, where there were human consequences for the decisions they took, and the moral burden that this government carries today, I would much rather carry the burden of Philip Ruddock and John Howard, because these men, similarly motivated by compassion and a genuine humanitarian interest, also understood that you've got to have strong rules on your borders in order to run a program with integrity, and in order to protect people often from their own ambitions and their own hopes by taking that terrible voyage to Australia by sea. Cornerstone of the Liberal government, though, was our commitment to skilled migration. Under that period of the Howard government, we increased the level of skilled migration of the permanent program from less than 30% under Paul Keating to almost 70% by the time we left office. That is why you saw the significant change in outcomes in unemployment and a whole host of other key economic measures amongst migrant communities. It was that economic participation that I think also significantly led to the social cohesion that resulted from people participating in our economy through the opportunity of employment, through the opportunity of engagement, by bringing people together and having those opportunities. It is critical that appropriate policies and strategies are in place to ensure Australia has the workforce it needs to boost productivity and secure strong economic growth into the future. And immigration has an important role to play in that strategy. The primary purpose of our immigration program is economic, not social, in our view. It's economic policy, immigration, not a welfare policy. The objective is to bring people to Australia who can add value and make a contribution. Traditionally, we have structured labour migration around our permanent program, comprising the points-tested general skilled migration program for independent migrants, the state sponsorship and the rapidly expanded employer-sponsored program. One of the Howard government's most significant contribution I referred to was that increase in the proportion that was for skilled migration. But permanent skilled migration, while it sits at 67.9% today, it is important that we keep it at those levels, and that's why a coalition government has committed now for some years that that figure will never fall below two-thirds under a coalition government. And unlike the Labor government, you will never hear a Liberal government or a Liberal politician say that migrants take Aussie jobs. We believe that if you run your immigration properly, then immigration creates Aussie jobs. If you do it right, if you make sure it's economically focused and it's about making a contribution and nation building, then it generates jobs. And I think one of the saddest things I have seen this year is the end of the bipartisan consensus that was brought about earlier this year when the Labor government embarked on its attacks on skilled migration and that dreadful rhetoric that migrants take Aussie jobs. You won't hear a Liberal politician say that. The growth in skilled migration in recent years has been driven by sponsored migration, which now accounts for more than half of the permanent program for skilled migration, whether by employers or under the state and regional schemes. At the same time, independent general skilled migration has fallen from the dominant component in 2007-08 to less than half of the total today. The shift in the composition of skilled migration is the consequence of government policy that has effectively contracted out the recruitment and settlement process for skilled migrants to businesses in the private sector. Favouring sponsorship programs can limit the pool of unattached skilled migrants available to companies, more generally in the economy, to fill shortages. However, it does have the advantage of allowing the program to respond more directly to the express needs of businesses who have the capacity to sponsor skilled migrants. The Coalition does not oppose this shift. In fact, we are encouraging of it. However, we recognise that over-reliance on the sponsorship program can disadvantage small businesses who do not always have the capacity to engage within that sponsorship program, but also can face skilled labour shortages at various times. Another feature of the employer-sponsored program is the high proportion of onshore applicants for permanent residence. Employer sponsors overwhelmingly recruit skilled migrants who are already in the country, particularly on a temporary 457 visa. Now, the majority of employment-sponsored visas are the result of these applications. So the notion of permanent skilled migrants actually coming from somewhere else in the world one day and then moving to Australia permanently is something that is well in our past. And the increasing trend now is for someone to arrive on some type of temporary visa and having proven themselves effectively and made the choice that they would like to stay and finding someone to agree with that proposition, particularly in our business sector, then they are afforded that opportunity. You could loosely describe it as a try before you buy program from both parties, from both the business and from the skilled migrant. This program, I think, and it was Professor Peter MacDonald who has been most outspoken in supporting this major trend and shift in the way our immigration program works, highlights the key, I think, credential for this approach, and that is having served in the country for 4 years and worked and paid taxes and been involved in the community, improved language skills and engaged, what better way to identify and pre-qualify someone for permanent residency in our skills program than that? This is a positive shift within our immigration program, and I think it continues to provide a sound basis for the program to develop in the future. It was that very notion when Tony Abbott said some months ago that 457s in that respect can provide a mainstay for the program. That's what we were talking about. People coming to the country temporarily, proving themselves, and then making an application for permanent residency. This is a positive pathway that hands the control of decision to a sovereign country. So these are the things we would like to see continue to be pursued. And what's important, though, is we understand that there is a temporary labour market within Australia, whether those in the unions or the Labour Party like to admit it one way or the other. There are, at any given time, around 1 million temporary entrants to the country living here in Australia. And many of those have work rights. They're students, they're working holiday makers, they're 457 visa holders, and various elements of these programs have different protections and programs which are attached to them. There is an existing temporary labour market within Australia, and what the challenge is for any incoming government is to ensure that we have the appropriate controls and processes around those programs, A, to prevent against abuse, B, to ensure the ongoing integrity of that program. The answer to that is not more regulation to tie business up and more union red tape, but having more effective enforcement methodologies and practices and resources. But thirdly, it is about recognising that unless you can provide a proper pathway, then there is the great risk that people will find themselves in a temporary labour market illegally, and they will be subject to very serious vulnerabilities. And we need to be aware of that. Just pretending that that isn't the case, pretending people aren't here in that space, I think is a recipe for disaster. So we need to be very careful going forward how we manage our temporary migrant entry into Australia, the opportunities they have, the vulnerabilities that they have need to be understood, and the protections that we can have around those things. And the coalition is very mindful of that, whether they're students, whether they're 457 holders, whether they're working holiday makers, or people here on any other temporary entry capacity. So we do need to find legitimate pathways with appropriate controls for temporary migration that prevent the abuse of programs designed for other important purposes and meet the labour needs of an expanding economy, economy that we want to see expand if we're elected to government. I'd like to talk briefly, if I've got the time, Gerard, about significant investor visas. Labor's announced this program a year and a half ago, and I remember it being announced. It was the same day they announced enterprise migration agreements, two policies that we immediately supported. And the enterprise migration agreements, well, it was one of those things that Labor announces, and when it comes to implementation, it all just falls away and nothing ever happens. With the significant investor visa, it's been a similar experience. The significant investor visa was first announced to attract migrants with successful businesses and investment experience within the subclass, and it was scheduled to commence in November last year. In theory, it's good policy. It has the potential to attract millions, if not billions, of overseas capital investment into projects that will stimulate the Australian economy and create jobs for hundreds, if not thousands, of Australians. But as we've seen so many times, a good idea has suffered in its implementation. To April 30, there have been 435 expressions of interest for this visa. 279 were invited to apply. 171 applications were lodged, and two visas have been issued. We should also... It's a fairly familiar story. The first visa was granted on the 13th of May 2013, 6 months after the announcement, and the second was granted in the same month. Now, we support this visa. We think it's a good plan, but once again, we have seen how this government, in making a policy, in its implementation, it can fall away. A slow program started, convoluted red tape, clumsy management, and insufficient resources to ensure the proper assessment of applications in a timely manner. The criteria, we think, for how the significant investment visa should work, we think can have some attention applied to it in the years ahead. It's been described as vague and unnecessarily prescriptive, creating further confusion and uncertainty in the marketplace. The proposed turnaround time of 9 months for a significant investor visa, we think, is just far too long. It is no wonder potential investors, and remember, this is a program where people are putting $5 million of investment into the Australian economy, are starting to get cold feet and looking at alternatives elsewhere. We recognise there are significant implementation issues that are holding up the progress of this program, and we look to remedy those if elected this weekend so it can remain an attractive investment destination for Australia and for those who are looking to immigrate to Australia on that program. We would like to send a clear message that we are open for business on this visa, but also put in place the assessment capacity to back that up. We will look to review the investment criteria for this program with a view to having a more flexible approach that could see more of the investment capital attracted under the program being available to more small and medium-sized businesses, including entrepreneurial startups. Such an approach would seek also to create the possibility of a broader range of what I term compliant investments, approved in advance and parallel to the visa application process itself. We should also look at this program not as a way to just secure $5 million by stapling a visa to the investment product, That will not be my objective with this program. The $5 million invested should be the first of hundreds of millions that would flow from someone making this decision. The $5 million should be the appropriate hurdle for someone to make the decision to come, but if we only look at it and that initial investment, then I think we'd miss the point of the entire program. That's not where I see its future. I'm not really after their money. I'm actually after them. The people we're seeking to attract to Australia under this visa have demonstrated their enormous entrepreneurial success. They are wealth generators, and wealth generators are always welcome in Australia. And that's the message we need to send them, because wealth generators are good for Australia. We think people who create business, people who risk their capital, people who go out there every day and create jobs off their own effort and off their own enterprise is what we need to see more of in this country. And this program is designed to bring people just like that to this country. To bring high net worth individuals who will transfer their wealth to Australia over a generation. This requires the scheme to be flexible with the residence requirements of the principal applicant, who will need to spend their time overseas, predominantly running their global businesses. Where we need to focus, though, is on the resident requirements for the secondary applicants and family members of the principal applicant, because we're looking to see that family anchor themselves here in Australia. Their kids going to Australian schools and universities, their kids taking over those businesses and moving the axis, if you like, or the centre of gravity of their global operations to this country. And Australia provides that opportunity. To be successful, this program will require, I believe, a dedicated assessment team funded by the application fees that have the requisite skills and experience to deal with the sophisticated financial issues associated with the application and the high-level checks that form part of this process. And I think we also need to have a more sophisticated and proactive engagement program to ensure this measure is delivering on what we are trying to achieve. Now, this means we need to be working with the business community and drawing on the contacts within our own ethnic communities within Australia to identify and target suitable applicants for the program, especially in China, India and the Middle East. Such an approach should link in with our broader trade and investment strategies in the regions. An immigration minister, in many respects, particularly from an economic context, is a bit like the recruiter in your local sports team. I was about to say rugby, but I wasn't going to just limit it to that. That's my area of interest, some Southern District fans in the room. But it is a lot like that. It is about trying to get the people on our team that makes us a stronger country. And principally, that is in the area of economic participation. That is also true in the student visa area, and I don't have the time to go into too much detail there, only to say this. The international student industry is vitally important to Australia. It is critical that we provide stability for that sector over the next 3 to 5 years. There has been a lot of change, some of it necessary, some of it ham-fisted, and some of it causing incredible damage and costing many jobs and much investment. The industry needs a time of stability from government. It needs a time of support from government. It needs a time of outreach into our key markets around the world to ensure that they know that an Australian government is entirely supportive and backs the strong educational product that we offer here in this country. But we're not selling visas, permanent residency, under our education program. We're selling education. And when I think particularly of the Malaysian student market to Australia, which was one of the least affected by the changes in recent times, that coming out of the Colombo Plan many, many years ago demonstrated that when you're selling a good education product and people know that's what they're buying, then the market can be quite resilient. And so we need to keep the focus on education, and we need to keep the processing of people's visas in relation to student visas, I think, to be as efficient as it can be and to be competitive. I don't think we should be competing, though, in the international education space on the type of visa that's being offered. Frankly, if I think if the UK, Australia, Canada, the United States and others could form some consensus on these matters and just allow us all to compete on the quality of our education product, then I think the immigration ministers from all of those countries and secretaries would be far happier. We should be competing on the quality of our education product, which is world class. Also on the English language testing issue, I'd finish on this point, Jared. We need greater competition in the provision of English market testing within our visa arrangements. There are many fine organisations which provide world-class testing to what we can define as a more consistent standard. In Europe, there is the framework that exists, which is used particularly in the United Kingdom as a way of better defining the scale of English language competence. I think we need to be a little more open-minded in the way we apply our English language testing across, if you like, the visa continuum. Today, as I was mentioning before, you have an initial entry on temporary visa, then you have a harder entry on permanent visa, and then, of course, you have the ultimate entry when it comes to citizenship. What I would like to see as an immigration minister, if we were given that honour, is to see people's English language skills improve over that period of time. That there are multiple gateways that we'd be asking people to move through. And the reason I'm saying that is I don't want the English language testing scheme to be used, as I fear it has been used by this government, as some sort of industrial lockout on behalf of the unions, making it far too complicated and trying to lock people out of various forms of visas. I want it to be there to help people get from one step to the next with their English language skills and to create the expectation within the scheme that that's what we anticipate and want people to achieve when they come to Australia. For this reason, if a migrant can get a job and speak English, we know it works. They are the two most important skills that we've learned over two centuries of immigration to this country. If we focus on English language and getting those skills up, and if we focus on the ability of migrants to participate in our economy, then we will continue to have that enormously successful, socially cohesive, multi-ethnic society that we all celebrate in this country. If we go down another path where these things aren't as important, then we write a recipe, I think, for failure that we have seen in other countries of the world, particularly overseas in Europe and the United Kingdom in more recent times. We have something quite wonderful in this country when it comes to our immigration program. We need to value it, we need to protect it, we need to ensure that we have the systems in place to preserve its integrity, because it will continue to deliver for us for generations. In immigration, if you get it wrong, the consequences are intergenerational. If you get it right, the same is true. And that's why we want to get it right. That's why we want to get control of our borders. We want to ensure our immigration program is focused on economics, not welfare, and that those who we decide can come to this country, we give them the start that they need to go on to become truly great citizens. I'll finish with this last story, because it goes to our refugee and humanitarian program. I accounted at the press club today. Last week I was in Townsville, and I met with a woman there who came to Australia, Nazifa, from memory. And Nazifa was she was an Afghan refugee. She was in Iran for 27 years. She was a school teacher. She came the right way to Australia. She applied offshore as an Afghan refugee in Iran. She was here in about mid-2005. She came with her four children. Her husband was able to join her 2 years later. All of her four kids, who couldn't speak a word of English when they arrived in Australia, went on to complete school at Townsville, at the state high school. They've all studied at university. One's completing a medicine degree as we speak this year. Another is a pharmacist. Another is involved in engineering studies, and another one in physiotherapy. And 2 years ago, they bought their own home in Townsville, where I met them and we had morning tea. I met them 3 years ago while they were partway down that journey. And that's a great Australian story. It's a greater story of Australian compassion, of opportunity, and at the end of the day, giving people a fair go who are prepared to have a go. And they're the people we want to decide to come to this country and enjoy the wonderful life that we can all share. By birthright for some, by pledge for others, but whichever way you do, it's a great thing to celebrate. Thank you.
Many thanks, Scott Morrison. So we come to questions and discussion in a minute. Could I just ask everyone who's asking a question, we take them from our members, of course, we're not taking questions from the media, just don't stand in front of that camera down there. Can I also say thanks to the Gallipoli Club for the use of this facility tonight. It's our first night here and it's worked well. So we come to question and discussion. We'll finish no later than 7 p.m. and there's a bit of water relief coming for the Shadow Minister. Okay. Thanks for your talk tonight and also for the historical input at the start of the speech, which set a lot of it in what you said in place, generally about Australia, but in particular about the coalition governments. As you know, our main times of immigration since the Second World War have been times of economic prosperity, the Menzies years, parts of the Fraser years, the Hawke years, and the Howard years. They were the times of large immigration. I know you can't look forward to exactly what the economic state is going to be, but have you had a thought about numbers if you happen to get elected on Saturday? I mean, firstly, what is your general thinking about the refugee and humanitarian take? And beyond that, would you have any aim about the general immigration intake in the other areas?
Sure. Well, currently, the permanent program is 190,000 skilled family and other types of entrants, with the 20,000 this government has announced for the refugee and humanitarian intake. On the overall permanent program, as I said, two-thirds of that will be skills at the very least, and I would like that to be higher than that. But the figure that is actually more driving population growth in the country today is not really the permanent program. It's actually the temporary migration program. More than well over half of our net overseas migration is coming from temporary entrants, not permanent entrants. And that is for the reason I said before, people are coming temporarily and then moving to permanent once they're on shore. So how we work in the temporary space is, I think, conditioning what the figures are going to look like on the permanent side down the track. And our entire immigration infrastructure has always been built around the permanent program, not so much the temporary program. And so the challenge for the next government, whoever's elected on Saturday, I think over the next 10 years, is to really reorientate how the immigration program provides support and introduction at the temporary level, not just at the permanent level. On the refugee and humanitarian intake, we have made the decision that we will be putting it at 13,750, not 20,000. But there is a big difference between what we're doing with the government. And it's not about the overall size of the intake. The big difference is this. Under our scheme, 13,750 visas will be given to those under the program, none of which will include those who have entered Australia illegally by boat. Not one. We are disconnecting that program from people who have come by a method we are seeking to prevent. The government is continuing that linked program. So of the 20,000 visas they're offering under that program, they will be taking visas out of that program to give to those who have already turned up on boats. And there are 32,000 people here waiting for a permanent visa from Labor on the other side of this election. And you can only have to do the math to work out what the impact will be on that 20,000 program because of that enormous backlog of cases. And Tony Burke was saying to me today, why would you only give temporary visas to people who are already here? For that reason, in that I want to make sure that the visas that we hand out permanently go to people like Nazifa, people who are waiting offshore. That's what the program's for. And so we are going to disconnect those two programs. What the ultimate, we will give temporary visas out of a different pool to those who are found to be refugees who are already in the country. And how many of those there will be? Well, we'll have a revised assessment process as well, and it will be however many are found to be genuine refugees. But what I can tell you is under the government's program, I think it is quite likely that under their policies, more people will get visas who have come the wrong way than have come the right way. And the number of people who come the right way and who get a visa will be less than under a coalition government.
Thanks.
There's a
question here? Yeah.
Scott, we're living in a time in which the entry of so many peoples into Western societies has come under a lot of scrutiny, not all for the best. I'm going to ask you a question that I asked Bob Carr when he was at a meeting at the Institute not so long ago. Why is it that immigration has been so successful, do you think, in the USA, although they also are under problems at the moment, but not so successful in Europe? What are the social problems? You've spoken glowingly of the economic advantages of immigration, but what are the social problems?
Well, we've had the same success as the United States have in this respect, and I think arguably more so, but, you know, that they may have a different view. But equally, I think it is one of the great things that we share between the United States and Australia, is that we have had a proactive, skilled-based economic migration program. That's not the case in the UK and Germany in particular. Post-war and post-colonial shift to independence in the UK, they had a return program, which meant they had a large influx of largely unskilled migrants, from a whole range of different cultures, and then there were the settlement programs that went with that, frankly, have been a complete disaster. And the same is true in Germany post-war, where their program was for some guest workers to come after the end of the Second World War, who were supposed to go home and never did. And they had similar programs of large pools of unskilled, uneducated labour within their societies. And then you had the inevitable descent into separation and segregation and all the cultural problems that go with that, and issues of national language diminishing. Now, I just want to make this point about national language in English. I'm not suggesting that Australia should be a unilingual society. Quite the opposite. I actually think we should be a multilingual society, and we should all be learning other languages. I'm hopeless at them, but I really hope my daughters will be passionate Indonesian speakers or whatever they choose. But we do have to have the common language of English that everyone can engage on. And I think that has struggled in those countries. In the United States and Australia, we went down the skill path. And that, I believe, more than anything else, is the reason why our migration programs have been so successful. And you can see it in the employment statistics. Our rate of unemployment is the same for the rest of the rest of the population, or better. The rate of educational attainment for second-generation migrants in Australia is better than the rest of the general population. The rate of incarceration is much lower or the same as for the general population. If you go to the UK or Germany, you'll find those statistics are wide chasm between the two, and then social disadvantage links up with ethnic disadvantage, and you have what you have. And that's why we say what we have here is quite special. We can't muck it up, and we won't muck it up if we stay focused on skills and economic migration.
Question here? Yeah. Yes?
Right. Some electorates are concerned about the large influx of refugees on the grounds that it's going to affect, on compassionate grounds, affecting the labour laws and, of course, the taxpayers in terms of welfare payments and so forth. So, in terms of compassion, many are concerned that how do you balance your policy that it is compassionate but also fair to the Australian citizens who are already living in Australia? So, the fairness.
Sure.
Convincing them, that is also fair to you.
That's why I think we need to have a sustainable refugee and humanitarian program. 13,750, I think, is a generous figure, but it reflects, I think, our generosity as a people, and even at that level is one of the highest per capita, if not the highest in the world, as I understand it. That's why I've always been hesitant about the government's plan, and particularly the Greens, to increase that to 20,000 or 27,000, Kevin Rudd is now saying. I think the consequence of that will be to overwhelm our settlement services. I think the consequence of that will be to diminish the opportunities and outcomes we're getting from our settlement programs for those who we're trying to take in. If we take someone in from whether it's the Sudan or Somalia or from Myanmar or any of these places, or we are going to have, I think, big challenges in the years ahead, particularly with what's happening in Syria and Egypt, then we've got to give people a fair go when they come. And we've got to give them support to get on their feet and make their contribution like Nazifa has. And we don't do that by just satiating a public, more of a left-wing appetite for large, big settlement numbers, which at the end of the day, I just think undermine our capacity to help those we've invited to come here. And so I would like to increase the intake potentially at some point, as I know Tony Abbott has said, but I would never do it if I thought it was going to compromise the settlement outcomes for those Australians who have come under that program and their ability to integrate into the Australian community, get a job and be able to learn the language and go on and live their lives in a productive way here.
We go to Tom and then over there. Yeah, Tom.
Scott, how will your immigration policy impact on the population replacement ratio, and how will that compare with other Western nations?
Well, our population growth rate is actually a lot higher than most of the other developed economies around the world, and we need to be careful about how quickly we grow our program, and I think we need to be very mindful of the impact on that. I mean, several years ago, before the last election, net overseas migration hit over 300,000 per year. Now, our long-run average is around about 140,000 per year for net overseas migration, and we're still well above that at the moment. We're up around about, well, it varies from month, quarter to quarter, but around about 200,000. And now, there was some good work done by Peter MacDonald some years ago, which said, after the last election, that if you run your net overseas migration program between about 160,000 and 210,000, then you can maintain your level of GDP growth per capita and not have a negative influence on that rate of growth. And so I think that provides a good insight into the sort of size of the program that you can run successfully. But I personally think that that type of research is something we need to do very, very regularly. You've got to be able to keep your population growth in balance with your expansion of capacity of infrastructure and services or so on, because that's when you get not only economic congestion issues, but you can also get very serious social issues.
Great talking, thank you.
Thank you.
I'm an Anglican Christian, and I wanted to ask you about how you're going to run your office, and you talked about your admiration for Mr. Ruddock's office and how he ran it, and I share that admiration, actually. As you may know, there are many Iranians in here who are having experiences within the Christian churches. In the Ruddock period, there was a good relationship with the churches, being able to make representation. Do you see that continuing? How would you like to see it happen?
Well, I do. One of the things Philip used to do very frequently was things like this. Not necessarily the Sydney Institute, but I'm sure he was a guest. Philip Ruddock, but
oh, he was.
Yeah, and those sort of dialogues are important. But he also used to run quite regular community engagement consultation nights during difficult times and during good times of the program. And Philip was always very open to receiving feedback, and he still does have outstanding relationships with the leaders of those communities. And I would hope to have the same thing, and we've been working on that. I mean, for example, at the moment, over the last few years, I've been working with the Coptic community, the Egyptian Coptic community, and there are so many places that we have in the program. There will never be enough, and you need to be able to triage the need about who you can help, and I think those communities are good guides in terms of working out who and where, and they're also important because they provide the networks of support beyond what the government does. I mean, one thing I acknowledge is that when people come to this country from other places, they are embraced within a community, and some communities can provide tremendous support. The Mandaean community is another one which has had difficulty getting people here out of Iraq, and it's one of the, you know, a very small community now in Iraq, and they have a large diaspora. But they, and the Armenians is another. It just goes on and on and on. So, yes, in short, a similar approach.
Can I? No, hang on just a second. No, we're going in order. Robin?
Thank you very much.
Hello, Robin.
I enjoyed appreciated your comment about the importance of Australian thinking on quality and matters of education. And from that, one might infer that it's very important that the ministers for immigration and education work closely together.
True.
Given the situation that we in fact compete with the United States and the United Kingdom for students from this part of the world, the same argument, on quality. And given that they are much better funded on a per capita basis in the United States, and also that Dennis Richardson, when he was leaving foreign, was asked a question as to how we might how he would advise as to how Australian universities might best compete, and he gave an interesting reply to the University of Student Experience. So my question is, how will you support the better financial support of the best Australian higher education institutions so we can, in fact, best compete on those qualities?
I think the question is, do we give more money to universities so they can compete? Doesn't take long.
You'll have to wait for Christopher Pine to come and address the Sydney Institute. One thing I've learned in my portfolio is to refrain from traversing to other colleagues' portfolios. Not that I've met a colleague yet who has any ambition for my portfolio. Where immigration comes into it is this. I don't think we should be providing visas as some sort of funding substitute. Visas can provide economic opportunities for universities and vocational education providers, of course. But I think they're two very separate questions, and that's why I quite legitimately say that what you're talking about is about boosting the educational quality and capacity of the product. Now, that is not something as an immigration minister I would have any involvement with. That would be a matter for the education minister. And so I'd invite you to have a chat to Christopher about those things. What we can do is make sure that there's a level playing field, the process works well, and that what we're not doing is sponsoring a rogue industry in education which is selling visas.
Now we'll get into the end, we've got to be brief. There's a question here.
Hi, Scott. Hi. Firstly, I applaud your humanitarian process, particularly with soft border policy, hard policy, but I think very humanitarian approach. You talk about temporary visas and the how they're such an important part of the process. Up until now, most of our temporary visas have been through employer sponsorship programs. Do you see an opportunity there for people to back themselves and, on a temporary basis and then that becoming a transition into permanent?
Well, that's really what I was getting at, George, when I was saying that we've got a lot of people who end up in this country and some of them end up working beyond their entitlements. And the government made a few changes a few years ago to come down with some quite heavy penalties on employers and others. And I was sympathetic to that. I think you've got to have enforcement, you've got to have penalties, and people should do the right thing. But you've also got to run a program which is practical and recognises the reality of what's happening out there. If there is not a legitimate place where people can come to Australia and have opportunities like this, then an illegitimate way will be tried on. And then you have, you know, potentially tens of thousands of people, sweat shops and these sorts of things, and sex trafficking and all of that. The compliance role of the immigration department almost gets used as an enforcer to those who are abusing people in these circumstances. I'll dob you into immigration if you don't do what I say. And I want to avoid those negative incentives. So I think we need to think a lot harder about how things work in that temporary space. As I said, the permanent program has been so much the orientation of the program and scheme for decades and decades. And the temporary space has just sort of evolved on its own, and here it is, bigger than half the program. So I think it's more, I endorse your question. I don't think there's an answer to it yet. And it's something that I think an incoming immigration minister on the other side of the election, whoever that is, has to turn their mind to.
There's a question here.
Scott, in terms of stopping the boats, what are the key steps? What's the time frame, and what are the budget, the potential budget savings?
Well, the three measures that I think we've... You could probably recite them with me, but turning boats back where it's safe to do so, and we've announced a serious support of the fleet, both naval and customs, to support that so they're not running a taxi service anymore. Secondly, genuine offshore processing. And I made some comments about the PNG election fix today. The great risk of this thing is they put all their eggs in one basket, and on 10 previous occasions they've predicted success out of 10 failures. And my great fear is every time Labor gets one of these things wrong, it actually gets worse on the other side. And so this thing goes wrong and the seeds of failure are in this. I mean, how they plan to resettle people in Papua New Guinea is a complete mystery to me, and they haven't been able to detail how that will be done, but it's central to their plan, and they also have problems on Manus Island. So we need to stabilise things on Manus Island for offshore processing and expand the capacity on on Nauru. Temporary protection visas, particularly for those who are already here, they will be applied. Reforms to the assessment process. We've talked about that. I mean, we have a tick and flick system at the moment where the rate is 9 out of 10 and the benefit of the doubt is heavily weighted in favour of delivering on the people smugglers' promise. There is also the issue of denying the taxpayer-funded support that is given to those who come by boat to make their claim and then to appeal it. That's not given to someone who's here legally, by the way. And then there is the issue of the regional deterrence framework. We've committed $420 million, joint operations with the Indonesian police, customs, the International Organisation of Migration, reaching out into communities, strengthening the borders in the region. Operation Sovereign Borders, which is under the command of a three-star military officer, brings all of these agencies together to fight this thing every day. And all of that is what you need. Now, PNG fails with this government, then they're back where they started. We will try and salvage as much of that as we humanly possibly can. But that's not the whole answer. The whole answer is everything we've said before and more if that's what it takes.
So just as a final question, as you started off historically, looking back historically over our times, is there any time you'd look back on Australian history and say there's an immigration minister you wouldn't mind following the example of, or there's a government that did it better than the others? What would you say?
Well, it would undoubtedly be Philip Ruddock. Because Philip, I think, had the balance of the need to ensure an economic focus, integrity and humanity. So for me, Philip has very much been a mentor, and I think he has championed, I think, getting the whole package together. But I'd also say this, Jared, and this is something I would hope to lead a debate on if we were successful. We need to understand that immigration in this country did not start in 1945. It started in 1788. We are all migrants. I may well go back to the First Fleet, which I do. So my ancestors didn't come out voluntarily. But they did come out on a boat. But, you know, several centuries later, I can identify my migrant experience, and you can as well, if you go back through your own history, leaving a culture that you didn't know, coming to another place which was unfamiliar, having to leave old troubles behind, and you know, whether it was Anglo-Saxons and Irish Celts having to get over the sectarian divides of their old country, and it took us a century to get over that. And so I sometimes shake my head at those who find it bemusing that others who come from other religious backgrounds find it difficult to make that transition when us Anglo-Celts didn't really, frankly, do it that well for over a century. And I think we have to be patient as people make that adjustment. If we reflect on our own migrant experience, no matter how many generations it goes back, I think it helps us understand the migrant experience of others. And I think that's where the Americans do this better than us. They understand they're an immigrant nation going back to the start. And the only forum I've ever stood in, particularly with colleagues, when I've talked about being an immigrant society, where someone could say, no, that's not just true for me, was in Hasluck with our member there, who was an Indigenous Australian. And I think that is then the other connection we have to make between the immigrant society and an Indigenous society, and all get together as a country that is truly united.
Many thanks, Governor.
Thank you.
I know there are more questions, but we're right on time, so I'll be very brief. The last time Mr. Morrison was at the Institute, he spoke about social policy. Tonight he's spoken about immigration policy, looking into the future if the coalition happens to win the election on Saturday. We've been very privileged on two occasions to hear Scott Morrison talk widely across a range of issues with great historical insight. Whatever the result on Saturday, we'd like you to come back again in the future, because I'm sure you're going to hold Cook. But for tonight, well done and good luck. Thank you. Thank
you. You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.